Here's a uniquely millennial twist on the racist dog whistle. You shroud your sincere ideas in cartoon characters and memes, and then when called out, you mock your accuser for being a clueless normie who isn't in on the joke.
That's Natalie Wynn. She is a video essayist and a political philosopher. On her YouTube channel, ContraPoints, she examines, dissects, and plays with internet culture. What you just heard was a clip from a video called Decrypting the Alt-Right. Her videos use a parade of personae, along with intricate, outlandish, creative costuming and makeup and set design to analyse these hot-button internet topics. Topics like white nationalism, the rise of the alt-right, gender identity controversies, and recently the popularity of the ideas of Jordan Peterson. She's had over 8 million views of her videos. She's popular. I spoke to Natalie Wynn earlier, and I started off by asking Natalie to describe, in her own words, what it is she does.
It's difficult to describe, but when I am forced to, what I say is that it's kind of a comedy and theater in the service of political discussion. So it's a YouTube show that looks at basically internet politics, and I, instead of just looking at a camera and talking in front of a bookshelf or something, I like to stylize it a lot. So there's jokes, there's costumes, I build sets, I have dialogues between different characters that I play myself. And it sort of dramatizes a lot of the political struggles, especially the ones that we have that are the most contentious one right now in my own country, in particular around race, around gender, around sexuality, and how all these things are going to fit into society as we move further into this century.
For people listening who've never explored politics as they are debated and presented on that platform on YouTube, is it fair to say, do you think, Natalie, that the politics of the left and the right play out on YouTube differently than they would on television, for example? You know, it's not so much about the economy on there, right? It's not so much tax reform that people are getting passionate about on YouTube.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that if you look at what the real topics are that are the sources of division between left and right online, much more likely than a discussion of healthcare or the economy, it's much more likely to be, say, a term like political correctness, which is kind of like the buzzword that divides people. And what that means oftentimes is like sometimes simply matters of etiquette around such things as transgender issues, around feminism, around racial politics. And sometimes, sometimes, of course, that also means much more than just etiquette. It means policy. It means, you know, what the United States is going to look like in 30 years. All of that is, I think, in part discussed on YouTube because it's something that a lot of times people are not super comfortable saying their opinion about in day-to-day life. And particularly when it comes to some of this like far-right or alt-right kind of racist stuff. I think traditional media has kind of gatekept that. That is, you couldn't really say some of the opinions that, you know, because it simply wouldn't be published. Whereas on YouTube, anyone can, with a camera, essentially can become a commentator. And that's what's happened.
You started making your work, your examinations and explorations of these ideas, these things like alt-right stuff and trans-exclusionary feminism, transphobic memes, all of this stuff, based around, I believe, a really simple idea. And the idea was, what if the things that people say on YouTube comments are true? What if they actually mean them? Is that right?
Yeah, it's not so much what if they're true, but what if they're sincere? So when I started doing this in 2016, I had moved to Baltimore in the United States. And right before I moved here, there had been this like worldwide news coverage of this event where this young black man in Baltimore, Freddie Gray, was killed by the police. And there was a subsequent uprising in the city. I remember reading the comments sections of YouTube videos that were sort of covering this and noticing just how vicious the racism was. And I thought, you know, people would tell me, oh, well, it's just YouTube comments. That's not serious. People just are trying to get a rise out of you. They're just trolling. They just want you to react and get angry. But that wasn't really the sense I got. And I think that that view of mine was confirmed in 2016 when, basically you saw the YouTube comments section president get elected. He was saying the things that people before had been saying in YouTube comments, and I think had been thinking all along.
Does that mean, Natalie, that you maybe weren't as surprised as some sections of the media in America, especially the so-called liberal media, about the election result in 2016?
Yeah, I think I definitely kind of had a premonition of that result, and or at least the forces that led to it, at the beginning of that year when I was sort of in these online spaces and watching just how, from my progressive perspective, how grim the situation looked at that time, because it seemed like progressive activists were completely being shouted down, like they basically failed to communicate their ideas to a larger public, and that there was this massive backlash kind of movement that was gaining a lot of power and gaining a lot of popularity.
Back in March this year, you tweeted. You said many of us spent days and days in 2017 arguing that the racists, and you have the symbols to define them, arguing that the racists were real and that they were dangerous and that their irony was a ploy. We were told again and again we were crazy, it was all a joke, we just didn't understand memes, we'd succumbed to paranoid delusions. How did you come to identify this in that way, Natalie?
Well, I basically just noticed it by spending time in the spaces where that organizing was going on. So the message boards, 4chan and 8chan, a lot of far-right YouTube channels, all of this had formed a kind of community. There was parts of Twitter, and once those accounts started getting banned, they made Gab, which was this Twitter alternative for basically far-right views. And I watched as it just got more and more extreme, and eventually, they had developed this kind of elaborate set of techniques that helped them, one, evade censorship, and two, kind of be persuasive to people who ordinarily might not get, sucked into such an extremist movement. And so that involves things like using memes and irony. So they will take, and that photograph, that hand gesture, thumb and forefinger brought together, like, which is a perfectly ordinary hand gesture, but they had sort of jokingly started making to each other, using the emoji online and posing with it in photographs. Like, there's photographs of white nationalist Richard Spencer posing like that. And it was this kind of wink, right, at each other. And also, kind of a way of mocking any progressive activist that pointed it out. Because when someone points it out, you can say, "You think the OK sign is racist? This is just another example of how progressive activists have become completely paranoid and delusional. They think everything's racist." And the kind of, they would use Nazi imagery, like, they would use Nazi flags or modified Nazi flags. And then, if you expressed any alarm at this, they would say that you just didn't understand the joke. And it sounds very like absurd, but it actually worked for a while. And that was scary to me.
And your tweet indicated that there was a sense of frustration that you were feeling, or part of a group or a community that was feeling a sense of frustration around attempting to sound an alarm about this or attempting to underline the gravity of this. Do you feel in retrospect, and it's easy, I know, in retrospect, but do you feel like that was underestimated, that wasn't heard?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I thought that, I absolutely thought that at the time. And the frustration I had at the time was that, people would just tell me, like, "Well, this is just nonsense on the internet. Like, this isn't serious." Like, and the people who are part of these extremist movements, like, they really benefited from that perception that it wasn't serious, or this perception that it was just kind of a joke, or this perception that it was just, oh, people messing around online. And, that's, I think, in a way, part of what made it dangerous, or part of what made it takes so long for anyone, on a wider scale to recognize that there was this very dangerous extremist organizing going on online, because it sort of presented itself in a way that seemed frivolous, which maybe sort of ironically made it actually more dangerous than as if it had appeared a serious threat from the beginning.
Which raises the question, to what extent do you think, Natalie, is the way we express ourselves on the internet, online, on YouTube, you know, on Twitter as well, maybe on Instagram to a lesser degree, to what extent is that a different kind of representation? You know, does irony function differently? It seems to me an awful lot of the instructive and educational value of what you do is because you are so adept when it comes to decoding and reflecting back certain sort of ironical positions.
Yes, well, I think irony plays a big part in the kind of the basic language of the internet. It's sort of how people communicate. It's part of the sort of cultural sense of humor almost. And I think if you look at what the far right extremists would do with it, actually what they were doing is not, in a way, well, it's either double irony, which is like sort of like a double negative. That is, it was kind of pseudo irony. They were saying what they really thought, but then when convenient, they would pass it off as if they were being ironic.
You're not, I know, just this person who tracks and engages with racist young men on the internet. I appreciate that there is a lot more to you and what you do, but that part of your story is so instructive, it feels to me, right now, especially in the context in New Zealand. So I want to stay on it. What brought you into this? It feels like it's a sort of a point of honor on the internet. You know, you don't feed the trolls. So
yes,
engaging with trolls and their questions in good faith feels like it's missing the essential point of trolls.
Well, there's something about the way that we discuss trolls that sort of ignores, I think, some of the common facts about trolls. Like, I mean, are there people who are sort of, we could say, true trolls, that is, people who basically will say anything to bother anyone online? Yeah, there's a few of those people, but a lot of times, like, trolling is not random, it's directed. And there's, you know, it's not just, oh, I like to offend everyone. It tends to be sort of weaponized against certain groups of people. And I think that, you know, if you talk to any journalist who is Jewish or who is not white or who is transgender or, you know, you or who is openly feminist, for example, like, suddenly you can be, you know, and they'll have stories for you about the constant harassment that they get. Now, is that trolling or is it targeted harassment? Well, the line is pretty blurry. Now, for me, I mean, I started making this content not because of YouTube comments necessarily, but because of YouTube videos. Like, I was being suggested. YouTube was suggesting to me on the homepage these videos about how feminism is cancer, Black Lives Matter is racist, how, you know, socially progressive campus activists are trying to destroy free speech. These were sort of the common talking points. And
can I ask, Natalie, can I just interrupt you? What had you been looking at to begin with that led you there, or that led you to that point?
Well, it's a little bit of a mystery, but one idea I have is that when I was much younger, you know, presumably with the same email login, I had been watching on YouTube a lot of content that was popular at the time, like 2009, that long ago, about atheism, which was kind of a popular debate topic of the time. There'd be, you know, all these atheist YouTubers who followed Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris, people like that. And they would have debates with religious people, and they would have, you know, all these. But, and so I had followed those people once, and I think that a few big ones, kind of ended up turning from, once that, you know, atheism versus religion conversation kind of died down at the beginning of the 2010s, they sort of, many of them turned out to be pretty reactionary in every other respect. They would talk about anti-feminism, and so I would get suggested those videos, and then I would get suggested related videos. And I think that's how I sort of found this stuff at first. But, you know, once you start, like, you really get sucked into a rabbit hole, as people say. Like, you can watch, you know, videos that are just making fun of Tumblr feminists or you know, or hysterical activists or whatever they like to make fun of. And then you end up led to these videos about, you know, race and IQ and skull shape and, you know, is feminism ruining Western culture and all this kind of stuff.
And this is interesting when it comes to a discussion about the platform, isn't it, Natalie? Because YouTube is like TV. It functions like TV. You watch moving pictures, but it isn't TV because your TV channel doesn't tune itself to something else that you might like based on your last browsing history.
That's right. There's a lot of differences between YouTube and traditional broadcasting. So, I mean, an obvious one is that traditional broadcasting, like, there's gatekeepers, there's people who are deciding what goes on air, whereas on YouTube, it's kind of whoever has a camera gets to have a voice. And as far as what you know, YouTube, obviously, it's not just random, the videos you watch, and you don't just entirely choose them yourself. YouTube suggests them to you because there's an algorithm that basically will recommend videos to you based on what videos you've watched in the past. And that's sort of eerily out of human hands. And the, you know, computer ends up telling you to, like, it's a little bit, no one fully understands how this works. I've even talked to people at YouTube who don't really know. And, you know, but it's in some ways it just tracks like keywords and things, whatever you have in the title of the video, for example. So again, if you're watching someone making fun of feminists, like, then you could get suggested other videos that have feminism in the title. And on YouTube, most of that was anti-feminist material at the time.
And we're just starting to ask, aren't we? Is this okay? Is this good enough? Is it good enough that nobody knows how this secretive algorithm works and yet it can steer us to so many places, as you say?
Yeah, the question was not really posed before because it didn't seem especially important, I think. I don't think anyone took YouTube very seriously. I mean, YouTube wasn't even taken seriously as entertainment, much less politics. But, you know, it's a platform where videos get millions of views. It's a lot of eyeballs. And so I do think, yeah, it's time to start taking this somewhat seriously.
Natalie Wynn is with us. Her YouTube channel is called ContraPoints. Because, as you say, Natalie, it's important because this is where young people, people under 30, under 20, are getting their information, getting their politics, not just their politics, but ideas of the world.
That's right. I think that, you know, when I've done events on college campuses, and the kids who are that age now, like, they, YouTube is often one of their primary sources of information about things. They watch, they'll spend hours in their dorm room watching these debates on YouTube or watching YouTube videos. And even younger kids, like, I know boys especially like to watch these video game channels. Some of those have politics hidden in them. And it's really kind of become the way a generation learns about the world in some ways.
There is an invitational aspect to your approach, to your work. To what extent is it motivated, Natalie, by a desire to teach, you know, to engage with that random college student, whoever she or he or they are, looking for information? Is that your audience? Is that your starting point?
It is my starting point. Yeah, I would say random college student or average college student is very much my target audience. A lot of my audience is actually a little older than that, but yes, certainly that's one of my biggest demographics is people of college age. So I do think, yes, I don't want to make videos that are simply preaching to the choir. I want to reach basically the same audience that a lot of those right-wing creators were trying to reach, which is people who might not know that much about these issues to begin with. So I sort of will make a video title that exploits the same kind of curiosity that people have when they click on a right-wing video. And then I will just, you know, do my own version of it. But
so does that mean you're sort of sneaking into their algorithms as well?
At first, that was definitely the case. I would make response videos and things that would, you know, respond to far-right or right-wing people, and then that's the fact that I responded to them. I would put their name, or their name would appear in the title or the metadata of the video, and then some of their audience would watch the video. So yeah, that was definitely something I did earlier on.
That
These
must
days
have
I
been
don't do that
fun.
so much.
Was that fun for you in terms of the responses?
Well, at first it was pretty, it was pretty negative. Like the first few videos I did really got overwhelmingly downvoted. I got endless nasty comments, and so I kind of adjusted my approach pretty quickly, I would say, to the point where I sort of knew that an audience was kind of coming kind of hostile, and it was my job in the first 60 seconds or so of that video to put something in there to at least throw them off their, secure ground, at least sort of defy their expectations of what I'm going to be. And that seems to kind of work as a way of making people open-minded. Like first you kind of shake them out of complacency, and then they're paying attention suddenly.
Yes, the style is singular. You brilliantly digest all of these arguments and positions of various groups, as you say. And you also explore the limits and the contradictions of these positions by embodying them. You look at your gender critical video. You have this alter ego, this gender critical feminist, as she calls herself. She looks like, who does she look like? She looks a bit like Maleficent. From,
Maleficent, yeah.
yeah, and she's got the voice and she's got the hair, and she's this incredible performative creation, and it's special. When did you realize you were onto something with that?
Well, that's a good question. I guess I first, there was always something a little bit theatrical to my presentation style. That is, I liked having imaginary dialogues with the person I was arguing with. But at a certain point, I guess the first time I really innovated past that was when I found out I could make different fictional characters. I would play both of them, and then I could sort of represent two sides of an issue. At first, I was using that when I myself wasn't quite made up. So there was this whole debate in 2017 about is it ethical to punch a Nazi? And my feelings about that were mixed. So I made two characters to advocate both sides and had to have them stage a little debate. Then that got a little bit more sophisticated later on when I would have like a fake political talk show basically going on again, where I played the host and two other characters who would have a debate. And sometimes what I would do is not just show two sides of an issue, but I would show that the way that the debate format itself can kind of privilege a powerful person over a vulnerable person, or the way that good rhetoric can trump good reasons and other things like that.
Yeah, the rhetoric's important, isn't it? And understanding rhetoric and parsing rhetoric, given that the platform itself is not neutral. It's not a neutral platform. And if this is where young people are being exposed to ideas, and we don't teach civics, and we don't teach rhetoric, and we don't teach even history is not compulsory in schools. There's the question, isn't there, of how well equipped are people to parse this stuff, to assess it critically, as opposed to seeing, say, an attractive woman from Canada saying, "Oh, transgender people have a delusion," or immigration will somehow lead to white genocide, in a sort of a faux rational or reasonable manner.
Yes, it's something that really kind of scared me on YouTube was the way that, just like you've described, these incredibly just very low-level emotional appeals would just grab a hold of people. This fear of, ethnic replacement, as you say, or the sense of unfairness, or like, this kind of thing. Like, I think it was a very powerful part of right-wing talking points in particular, is that they were able to create a narrative out of these very like psychologically fundamental kinds of anxieties. I mean, to me, it was always very telling that the biggest insult that I alt-right would use to call people was cuck, as in cuckold, which is like I don't know why they chose something that seems to reveal so deep a level of psychological and sexual fixation, but I thought it was fascinating, and it's something that's kind of stuck with me as I've done this channel, that, you know, people don't necessarily believe things just because they thought, you know, because of logic. Or persuasion isn't just logic. It can also come from something that's, like, you know, psychologically deeper, that comes from some kind of lizard brain response, you know?
That's really interesting in terms of your approach, because the inclusivity of what you do, you know, you have fun with these ideas and these people where appropriate. It's not just a super sort of rational and nuanced and historically accurate demolition of the ideas of Jordan Peterson. You also call him daddy, and it's funny.
Yes.
But there is a sort of a willingness to engage on a psychological and emotional level, it seems to me. How important is it for you, Natalie, to understand people like incels or trans-exclusionary feminists, not just rationally and intellectually, but emotionally?
Well, I think that it's extremely important to me. In fact, I think it's kind of the core of what I think is sort of unique about my persuasive approach, or at least in also not just my persuasive approach, but also just my approach to my own personal understanding of these issues. I think my approach, I've described it as being more psychological than philosophical, and that I want to know not just like the reasons people give when you ask them why they believe something, but also like why in a psychological sense they believe it. What motivations, what fears, what desires, what anxieties do they have around this topic? And, you know, I think that when it comes to something like incels, involuntary celibate men, like, you know, you really can't understand them just by taking what they say at face value, because the things they're saying at face value just don't make any sense. It's just not thinking of a logical person to conclude from the fact that, like, you know, you haven't had any dating success so far, that you are horribly ugly and your life is worthless. Like, that is catastrophizing. That is the thinking of a person who is anxious or depressed. And so in order to really understand them, you can't just take them at your word. You have to look at their thought patterns and think, not necessarily like a psychoanalyst, but at least like a novelist who's asking why a person does the things they do. What is their mind like? What are their motivations?
You're on the left, broadly speaking, you know, as these mm-hmm. sort of clumps go, but you're not, they're not getting a free pass either. I mean, there were some really, I thought, well thought out digs at trauma-centered feminism and identity politics in your gender critical video. You have a sort of a clear-eyed understanding of the limitations of those points of views as well.
Yeah, I'm someone who's like, I am broadly on the left, but I'm also often very frustrated with the experiences I've had in leftist spaces. I think that people on the left are extremely hard on each other, that there's a lot of infighting, that there is, as you say, like there's this like, yeah, trauma-driven thing where people feel like their politics needs to center around their own personal grievances. All this is very frustrating and makes it quite difficult to organize and to work in leftist spaces. And it is definitely something, a theme that you see in a lot of my videos.
And what's the pushback to that been like? I mean, I noticed at the beginning of Gender Critical, you qualified whether or not you could speak for all trans people and instantly said, of course you couldn't, and you probably would get it wrong, and they probably would tear you to shreds on Twitter.
Well, I have at this point a long history of being torn to shreds on Twitter, sometimes over genuine mistakes and sometimes over absolutely insignificant nonsense. And I would say that, Twitter is, as a platform, kind of, I think, bad. It sort of encourages people to take little snippets of someone out of context and make them look bad for clout and attention. I think that, you know, it's just been a source of constant, like, sadness and difficulty for me that so many people who have leftist politics are just spending all their time just trying to tear down other people on social media. And I have kind of just accepted it, honestly, that it's just going to happen. And so the consequence is that I just basically have stopped caring what people say about me on Twitter, which I think is a pretty healthy position to be in. Though I do wish it hadn't come to that.
Yeah, that is. Does that say something about the nature of the discourse on the platform itself? You know, is there something about the platform? Because just to go back to your initial inspiration, you know, the things that people say in the comments on YouTube, you read the comments and they can be so horrifying. Is there something about being on the internet that turns us into the worst versions of ourselves?
Oh, I think there's a lot of things about the internet that sort of make it possible for people to behave so badly. Yes, I think that, you know, maybe at the core of it is you're just not face to face with people. There's this feeling of unreality almost where, you know, people who are writing online, sometimes it's almost like you're writing in your diary or something, and you can just say these things that you would never, ever say to a person's face. Like, I know that most, you know, these Twitter outrage, you know, storms that I've got weathered at this point, like, if this was all taking place at a town hall meeting in a gymnasium at a local high school, no one would get up to the microphone and say the things that they'll say about me on Twitter, because they have a sense of decency. But on the internet, there's not a sense of decency because you don't really have to. It's easy to avoid confronting the people you're talking about as real people. And that gets only worse when people start thinking of you as a celebrity or as a famous person or as like an influencer. Like, then people don't really have a sense of you as a human being who will actually read what they say, one, much less care about it.
And that's a strand of your own story, isn't it, Natalie? I mean, you transitioned as you were making these videos and in a very short space of time became like this emblematic trans person.
Yeah, it's bizarre, actually. I mean, it happened in a limited way almost immediately. And that was really difficult when it came out, because when you come out as trans, like, you don't know that, at least I didn't. I did not know that much about the community. Like, you sort of don't know who you can trust and who you can't. And so I made some missteps and got very harshly criticized. Plus, when you are a high profile person from a community that doesn't have a very many high profile people, there's this immense pressure on you to basically be the mascot for the whole community. And it's just not possible for one person to be that much of a representative. You know, there's always going to be people who feel that you haven't represented them well, or that you've talked about trans issues in a way they disagree with, and now, you know, it's your fault that everyone's wrong about this. Like, it's not an easy position to be in. It's extremely difficult.
Not to mention the fact that, you know, you're playing out performances that are being viewed by an audience that would view you as a sort of a red rag to a bull anyway, right? You know, a constituency that's not into trans rights, full stop.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's just a very, you know, there's a whole lot of things about this that are very difficult. Like, there's the fact that, you know, trans people often get treated like as less human. And online, that just gets even worse. There's the fact that, you know, I started making videos before I transitioned, and the whole awkward thing is just the history of it all is online forever.
It's there. Yes, that's not good. What's that like, having that part of your history online forever?
It's pretty awful. In a way, basically, I deal with it by just not even thinking, by just not thinking about it. Like, I do not watch my own videos ever. And that sounds kind of extreme, right? Bad, but I think in a lot of ways, transitioning is literally a second adolescence. And it has all the awkward little stages that you have to go through, the little experimentations with how you dress and how you identify and how you present yourself, how you speak. And like, I'm too insecure still. I can't deal with it. My hope is that someday, and I don't know, maybe 5 years or 10 years, I will be able to look back on this and just be proud of how far I've come, instead of be ashamed or embarrassed about the little awkward baby steps along the way. But for now, yeah, I basically just deal with it by not dealing with it.
Natalie Wynn is with us. ContraPoints is her enormously popular YouTube channel. Is that where the camp comes in, Natalie? Is that part? I mean, it just looks like great fun anyway, dressing up as a lobster queen or Maleficent or whatever it is. But is that consciously playing it up as part of a strategy?
Yes, I think so. It is fun and I do enjoy it. But I also think that this kind of the camp stuff, it gives me this opportunity, this fluidity of presentation and appearance and identity that lets me find something playful about what otherwise would be sort of a very awkward and embarrassing sort of journey. Well, I can take my experimentation with my own presentation, and that's why I do this kind of like drag queen stuff. Well, because it's an opportunity to experiment with going too far in one direction or another, and instead of having it be an awkward mess, have it be performance art or something, you know? And so playing characters, it's a way of finding myself in a sense.
Just to go back to that point we were talking about people being rotten on the internet. I wonder, is that why, do you think, people who don't go there regularly, you know, people whose experience of democracy or politics is the town hall, as you said, or television, is that why it's written off or sort of dismissed? Because there is the question there, isn't there, to what extent is so-called mainstream media failing to understand the right, the alt-right, the relationship between ideas and actions, which then explode into appalling violence?
Well, I think some of it is simply that newer media are generally taken less seriously at first. That seems to be changing pretty fast with the internet, the internet obviously has been around long enough that it is pretty established, but there are parts of it that are sort of not viewed as legitimate, like YouTube, for example, is kind of, it's viewed as like a teenage platform, which in a lot of ways it is. But teenagers are people and they grow up into adults, and so there's something kind of serious about that too. So I think that, especially when it comes to the far right, like fascist stuff, 4chan, I mean, 4chan is a place like no one wants to be on 4chan, really, except 17-year-old boys. It's a very, very unpleasant experience. And so there's a difficulty of even looking at it, much less taking it seriously as a place where political opinions are shared. But 4chan and 8chan, they were sort of crucibles for the development of basically a hate movement. And so we're sort of stuck having to take this somewhat seriously.
And what about the question of the platforms themselves? You know, again, you look at the relationship between words and deeds and wonder, don't those platforms need some policing as well? Don't we need to put more pressure on them to take responsibility? It's not enough to say, well, here's a mysterious algorithm and this is how it works, by pushing you further and further along in whatever train of thought you may be taking.
Yes, there's been this immense pressure put on YouTube lately to do something about the fact that they allow extremists on their site and that their algorithm seems to make the situation worse. I think there's things that YouTube could do, but it's not an easy solution either. I think sometimes people sort of oversimplify, what it would take for YouTube to stop this, because I think that in my experience, YouTube's attempts at stopping hate speech have been very ineffective, because I don't know exactly the statistic of how much content is uploaded to YouTube, but something like, it's like an hour of video every few seconds or something. And so there's just no way that, human beings are going to be able to moderate all of that. So it sort of has to be done automatically. Now, what I've discovered when it comes to dealing with extremist views is that a lot of times the extremists are pretty savvy about avoiding censorship, and that they form dog whistles and things like, they'll never call themselves Nazis, of course, they probably won't call themselves white nationalists either. They'll simply say that they're people who are concerned about demographic shifts or you know, whatever they have to say. So, like, you know, they can always just find a new phraseology that won't get picked up by, you know, whatever algorithm it is that's there to deal with flagged hate speech. Plus, the extremists themselves can use the reporting system on YouTube to get their opponents censored. So I, earlier in my career, had a few videos being taken down or being taken down. And it was because, you know, you make a video that's anti-Nazi, but the anti-Nazi video shows a swastika in it. Well, the video gets reported by Nazis. The computer detects that you've shown a swastika on screen and decides that it's hate content and takes the video down. So it's not very sophisticated. I mean, obviously, human beings at YouTube could do things like, you know, demonetizing channels by, like, the latest, you know, controversy going on about this is Steven Crowder, who's been homophobic bullying of another journalist for years now. Steven Crowder, it should be against YouTube's terms of service if you buy the letter, but Steven Crowder's still here, still making money. So it's difficult to say exactly, because, you know, on the one hand, you know, when a lot of platforms banned Alex Jones of InfoWars, I think that his being banned really improved these platforms and really helped prevent damage that he was doing. But on the other hand, like, how much do I trust Google and Facebook to decide what content should stay and what content should go? Unfortunately, I don't have that much trust.
And how much of an inviolable principle is free speech, or should it be? It feels like a lot of racist people and misogynist people seem to interpret free speech as their right to be as racist and or misogynist as they want. How do you see it?
Well, exactly. And in some sense, I think, you know, at least the U.S. Constitution does legally grant them something like that right. But when it comes to these platforms, you know, YouTube doesn't have to abide by the Constitution. And I think that it doesn't have to be that unrestrictive. But it's not at all easy to say where to draw the line. I think that, you know, clearly when you have a lot of content being produced that seems to have helped build a movement that's led to a lot of mass killings, that's the time to really think, we might want to take some of this down.
You, just to go back to that invitational approach of your work, Natalie, do the work is something you hear a lot. One hears a lot on Twitter, on social media, especially from the sort of the so-called woke, you know, the woke left. Mm-hmm. It's not my job to educate you on X,
yes,
Y or Z. But that's what you're doing. You know, you do that work. You do educate. You do present the other point of view and engage with it in good faith. Is that the vocation for you? Or, you know, did you just want to make theater and this is how you make it?
Well, it is my job to educate people, but yes, I think that it's some of both. I think that at my core, like, what really is, like, my, like, dream, I guess, is to be an entertainer. So it is, in a sense, the theatrical element, but I also, I don't know, I have, like, a strong conscience when it comes to this kind of thing. Instead of just and I find myself getting drawn into it. So to me, it's kind of the perfect hybrid, is to make this kind of theatrical or artistic content that's also about these issues that I find to be so important, because it's kind of the sweet spot of what you want out of a job. Like, it's paying the bills, it's, you know, doing a little bit of something to what I think is making the world better, and it's also creatively fulfilling. So it's really kind of all came together for me, and it's to see it having some kind of a positive impact on people, it means a lot.
Because that feels like, you know, one of the most pertinent criticisms of sections of the left right now, this idea that, you know, lived experience is a kind of a trump card that can be played in order to shut down any dissent or debate.
Yeah, and I understand why that kind of talking point has come up, right? That people just kind of get frustrated with people who like don't know anything about their lives or experiences, telling them as if they do know. But the fact of the matter is that, I mean, when you're transgender, like there's so few trans people that it's really best to accept as soon as possible the fact that most people don't really get it. And so if you want them to get it, you're going to have to explain it. And so that to me, I think has been something that's really been helpful in terms of getting me to, you know, develop techniques for explaining to these issues. It's, you know, not just a matter of wanting to educate people, but also at a more basic level, a matter of wanting to be understood.
Your videos make me laugh and they relax me. You know, they make me feel like maybe everything's going to be okay. But they're coming out, Natalie, against a backdrop of increasing, it seems, polarization, you know, not just in America where you are, but in societies all over the world. Is there a sort of an urgency to what you do? Do you feel that?
Oh, I absolutely do. I mean, I work so hard on this stuff that my friends and family are often, they call it the video cave because they just lose me to it. I spend so, you know, so much, three weeks a month, basically. I'm basically doing mostly this. And a lot of the reason, you know, it's not like working hard at a corporate law firm or something where I'm just like, well, I have to, and I make money. Like, it's not that. Like, I just genuinely feel a drive to work, you know, at a somewhat manic pace. And it's in part because I feel like I'm in this unusual situation of suddenly being handed, or not being handed, but having grown over a few years, this big platform that is capable of dealing with important topics at a time when it seems to really matter. So, you know, I do have this like sense of like, I have to make the absolute most of this opportunity. And, you know, that's kind of, it increasingly looks like this is kind of what my life has done. This is my work, and I care about it deeply. So yeah, I do feel that sense of urgency.
And I hadn't thought about that. Does the size of the platform make it worthwhile? You know, it's not like you're changing minds or trying to win arguments one at a time on Twitter, is it?
Yeah, well, it absolutely. Like, I mean, you know, I've noticed that there's a power that comes with having a larger platform. Like, I made this video called Are Traps Gay, which is about the sexuality of men who are attracted to trans women. And the Are Traps Gay is this kind of like edgy, awful meme about it. But I, you know, when I made that video, I knew from past experience that this video is probably going to be the first thing that comes up when a person does a Google search for the phrase Are Traps Gay. And so, you know, whereas before I could just, you know, anything I said was just my little contribution to a wider discussion. But now, like, if I talk about a niche, like a fairly niche topic like that, like, I know the video is going to dominate it for at least several months. So that's a big responsibility. And that's exciting that I get to have that opportunity. It's also scary. In some ways, it was more fun and more free and more exploratory early on when I didn't have this sense of, if I'm, you know, because this is kind of the other side of that coin, right? If I mess this up, like, that's bad.
What an interesting use of a background in philosophy. I haven't mentioned that, but you were going to get your PhD. Is this a lot more fun?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I do not have the temperament of a professor. That was never going to work out. Well, I don't know, maybe. But I could have been a fun professor, I guess. But like, you know, research was not for me, for certainly. I just could not stand sitting around inside close reading Hegel all day. And I think that, you know, there was so much. There were 2 years that I was in grad school, and there were so many afternoons I remember of just dying of boredom, sitting there working on some paper. And so it is pretty fun to be able to do something similar to what I was doing done on YouTube, but do it in my way, in a way that keeps me interested. To be able to, like I did in that Jordan Peterson video, say things like, "I'm going to divide modernism into two parts because I feel like it." Like, and you could just do that because it's a YouTube video, no one's grading you.
Do you think it's it's the philosophy background coming into play as well, that, you know, that that rigor that comes, that the critical rigor that allows you to interrogate your own experiences, because you're always starting from you. You're starting from where you are and turning that into a bridge to reach an audience. You know, you can foreground the subjective, but not really wall yourself off.
Yes, I think that I always certainly think that studying philosophy has helped me in a couple of ways. And one of them is, like, I've talked about sort of psychological empathy, but there's also something that you call like intellectual empathy, which is something that I think you get from studying philosophy. Like when you're, you know, you read books by Aristotle and you're supposed to write papers arguing against or in favor of Aristotle, which in order to do that, you have to understand what this, you know, extremely intelligent man, like a genius, no doubt, but from 2000 years ago with a lot of strange ideas thought. And that requires you to like put yourself in the mind of a person living in, you know, 5th century BC Athens. And, you know, if you can put yourself in the mind of ancient Athens, then you can put yourself in the mind of an internet edgelord, and the same thing is useful.
And finally, Natalie, do you feel your audience have moved with you as you transitioned? Do you think you have the same audience now as when you started, just a lot more of them?
Oh, it's changed a lot, actually. When I first started, it was mostly men. I think it was, you know, it was something like 80% men, 20% women would watch me. And it's now pretty close to 50-50, based on my YouTube analytics anyway. I think that also politically, you know, I've gone from basically, you know, not just not preaching to the choir, but at first I was preaching to the choir of a different religion. And I now think that I've acquired, you know, a lot of fans who kind of show up not expecting to hate me, but expecting to like me. And that sort of changes things. And again, it gives you a different kind of responsibility where you realize that you're sort of leading people. And there's a significant portion of your audience you're not trying to, you know, persuade or to de-radicalize, but you're just kind of pointing them where they'll go wherever you point. And that's a kind of new thing for me too.
Natalie Wynn, her YouTube channel is called ContraPoints.